To celebrate the 100th program of You Must Remember This, we were fortunate to interview Tom Brokaw. We're going to present in Here and Now some segments of the interview. Hear the whole interview tonight at 8 o'clock. We're really thrilled to have as our guest Tom Brokaw and to really talk about Tom Brokaw's book. So, Tom, at the tail end of your introduction to the book, you say, "This is the greatest generation any society has produced." Tell me, what do you mean?
Well, there have been, there have been people who say that's going too far. And when I came up with the idea of calling it that, which I had tried out in commencement addresses and other lectures, I really had thought through it. It was the generation that survived the Great Depression and then saved the free world, with the help of the Russians, we need to say, from the greatest tyranny this world had ever known. Nazi Germany was determined to conquer the world and impose upon it all their hideous policies. And these young men and women who had gone through such a terrible trial in the Depression answered the call, served gallantly, sacrificed their lives, their limbs, and the best part of their youth. Bob Dole often says to me, "I take 4 years off my life because of the 4 years that I was in uniform and wounded." And they left their homes and farms and city neighborhoods, and they became flyers and infantrymen and radar experts and intelligence experts and paratroopers all over the world. It was fought on all the continents, all the seas, and when it was over, more than 50 million people had perished. But we had a free world again, and we owe it to that generation. So I really did think they were the greatest generation. Others have said, "What about the founding fathers?" I say, well, the founding fathers did not allow women to vote, and they kept slavery intact. As genius as they were in creating a new form of government, I don't think that they represented a man for man, woman for woman, the same way that the people who were involved in World War II did.
Well, it seems to me, in going through the book, it also seems to me there was a shared goal among those from the 40s to 45.
Well, there certainly was, and I often tell contemporary people, I have a brass clicker I use that the 82nd Airborne had on them when they flew over the English Channel, landed in the middle of the night behind enemy lines, and the way they connected with each other is that they had what looks like a child's toy, a cricket, and they would click it once, "I'm here," and hope in the nighttime that they would hear a two clicks, "I hear you and I'm coming." And when they did that, that very rudimentary way of forming up, they didn't say when they met, "Are you a Republican? Are you a Tea Party member? Are you a Democrat? Because I only work with Democrats, or I only work with Tea Party members." They had a common goal, and they wanted to get the war over as soon as possible to defeat that hideous enemy and get home again. That was their big goal.
I'm, by the way, of that generation. I'm a little older. I was born in 1935, so some of the things that are talked about in the book I experienced as a little kid. But one of the things that impressed me in going through the book is that it didn't matter if you were rich or poor or from South Dakota or Oregon, everybody was sort of equal. You mentioned Bob Dole a little bit ago, and Tim Russert, and Joe Lewis, and Ted Williams, and Red Brokaw.
People like Ben Bradley, who came from a Brahmin Boston background, very privileged life, and George Bush, 41, who grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut. They had really led an elitist life until they got into service. And I remember President Bush saying to me, until I had to read the letters that were going home so that they weren't giving away any secrets, I didn't fully understand what it was like to live in a very difficult part of America with a farm going broke and no air conditioning and divorce. He said, that was not part of my life. I learned about life from them. And Ben Bradley said that he became a great newspaper editor, he thought, in part because of the relationships that he had with the men on the ship that he was on. And that on the fantail of the ship on the way home after the war, they sat around and talked about what they wanted to do. And almost all of them, he said, wanted to perform some kind of public service. They wanted to be school teachers. He wanted to be a journalist. They wanted to go into government. And he said it was a very leavening effect on him because he no longer was a Brahmin from Harvard. He was now an American fighting man sitting side by side with farm boys and with kids from the inner city, and it changed his life.
One of the titles that you have for a section of the book is titled Shame. You feel comfortable talking about that?
I do. I thought it was very important that we remind everyone of the sacrifices that were made by people of color and Asian ancestry. And they were all American citizens, and yet they were separated. In the case of the Japanese Americans, the outrageous removal of them from their homes and their businesses and sent to these isolated internment camps. I've been to one of them, Heart Mountain in Wyoming, and I can only imagine what it was like in the wintertime. You've been living on the California shore, running a small vegetable store or a business of some kind. Suddenly, you're picked up and shipped to this place, bleak, cold, concertina wire everywhere. You have had your citizenship stripped from you. And then, of course, the 442nd, which was the then Inouye Battalion, was the most heavily decorated in the Southern European theater. All Nisei Americans and African Americans who served heroically and often in the worst jobs, working in the galley or they were loading ammo. They were not getting nearly the recognition that they deserved. We all know about the Tuskegee Airmen, but there were other units as well that were awfully brave, including on D-Day. I had a friend who was a prominent Wall Street executive, and he was a junior officer on a ship. And he said the black men who worked down in the galley knew much more about how to operate a navy and a ship and go to war than I did. And yet they were forced to just serve me my breakfast in the morning. And he taught me all I need to know about racism at that point.
There's one story here, the Martha Putney story in the book. Share that with us, will you?
She was a wonderful woman who grew up in Pennsylvania in a black neighborhood and wanted to do better in life, and contrary to all of her family's expectations, went to work for a Republican because he could get her, he thought, a college education. And so she did. And then when the war broke out, she could see that that was going to provide more opportunities. So she became an early member of the Women's Army Corps, WAC, and she was assigned to a hospital unit. And they were in Des Moines, Iowa, but again, segregated. They couldn't use the swimming pool the same way the white women did. They got to use it only at the end of the day, a couple of days a week. And so they successfully got that integrated. But the most telling story was that she was on a temporary assignment down in Texas. And when they crossed into the South, she was told that she could not sit in the integrated cars. And the conductor came and told her that she was sitting in the wrong place. And there were two MPs on board who were summoned, and they recognized her as an officer. And they said, "Sir, this is an officer. She'll sit where she wants to," and she did. She took those lessons home to Howard University and taught history there until the end of her life. She was a tiny, frail-looking, but extremely strong woman. Whenever we had her on the air after the book was written, she got on the plane or the train on her own. And the day that they buried her at Arlington, I got Colin Powell to go with me and to stand off to the side and comment on all that she meant to his own career and to the idea that the African Americans who volunteered for service should have been treated equally as well.
There's a side story with her as well, with German prisoners of war and how they were treated compared to her.
They were German prisoners of war, not just in her case, but in a number of places around the country, were admitted to white officers' clubs of the United States Army that were denied entrance to our African Americans who were in uniform. Imagine that. Imagine the cruelty of that kind of thing. When an African American had to stand outside an officers' club and see German officers being treated by American white officers, that was not unusual. One of the men that I interviewed later won the Medal of Honor in Northern Italy. But before he got the Medal of Honor, which he richly deserved, he only had the Silver Star, but he was wearing the Silver Star after he came back from the war and he stayed in the Army. And he was walking across a base and a white Southern colonel came up and called him the N-word and said, "Take that Silver Star off. No N-word ever won a Silver Star." The horrendous treatment of these people. And when I'd say to them, how did you put up with it? They'd always have the same answer. It was my country. My country, too, and I was fighting for it and for my children and their children. So they were heroic, not just in their physical actions, but in their mental attitudes as well.
Wonderful story.
That was Tom Brokaw referring to his book, The Greatest Generation. More of the interview can be heard on You Must Remember This, tonight at 8 o'clock.